Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofawakin.
This week, Google Plus may be dead, but Google's self-driving cars are on a roll. Can police search cell phones without a warrant? Denmark in Minecraft, 3D printed prosthetics, and a long-lost legend is unearthed in the desert. All this and more this week. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and you can leave us a review if you subscribe to us on iTunes. All of our subscription links are in our show notes. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show's also at Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. And please, you know, give us feedback. We love to hear from you. We want to hear feedback from you. Tell us how we're doing. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And Dwayne, I've got nothing, but Dwayne, you've got something that you've been playing with recently.
Yeah. Even before that, I just wanted to thank everybody who sent me an email regarding the whole engagement thing. It was awesome. I got a message from like five or six people because Andy like put it on Facebook. And one of which was my my like tech mentor, David Petty, the guy who kind of like got me into building computers and stuff back in like the late 90s and everything. So yeah, thanks to everybody. But yeah, so my toy this week is called the Egg Minder. It's from Quirky and GE. And what this device does is, I mean, it's pretty quirky. It's a device that is basically an egg tray. It holds 14 eggs because for some reason 12 wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. And it's Wi-Fi connected. And what you do is you put your eggs in this device in your refrigerator, and it keeps them, you know, sealed, cold, whatever. But it also keeps track of which egg you put in first and how many eggs you have. And then whenever you open your refrigerator, it syncs out, it connects over Wi-Fi through your router to the servers, and it updates your interface to show you kind of how many eggs you have and what you know, which one you should be going for next. Now, when you take it out of the fridge and you open it up, a little blue light shows up next to the egg that you should use next. This device comes across as completely superfluous.
It does.
But it isn't.
I will say. Initial thought is it's pretty superfluous.
Okay, so here's what's happened.
Convince me.
I don't know if I can convince everybody that this is a must-have. I don't think it's a must-have, but as a guy who likes science and as a guy who likes tweaking and tweaking like little things and all this stuff, I found a hidden passion in baking things. Why? Because baking is like pretty chemistry set. Like you add this much of that and that much of this, and the chemicals are gonna whatever, and boom. When you live in high altitude like I do, you have to mess with these equations a little bit or these like you know expressions a little bit because things don't rise, whatever. When you bake, you use eggs. You do. And a big piece of baking is, you know, I do it probably once a week. A big piece of that is knowing how many eggs you have, and I wanted that, you know. And I looked at some other devices that, like, try to take a picture in your fridge and other thing. But a lot of them are on Kickstarter. They're not out yet. And I wanted to get something from Quirky. I was on the site. I was looking around. I had already wanted something to help me figure out eggs and butter. Because, I mean, it sounds kind of pedestrian, but really, I guess never know how much eggs and butter I have. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting on the Quirky website, and if you haven't been there, check it out. Because it's got all these, like, it's like a really applicable to your life Think Geek website, right? So thinkgeek.com, but less about the pop culture and more about super useful life hacky things. Anyway, I got this thing, and it doesn't work so well. It doesn't. It's, sometimes I pull out my phone and there's a Wink app and it's got a very clever way of syncing. Basically, when you first get the device, you put the batteries in, you like let it like start blinking, whatever. It's got a sensor. You open up this app that Quirky has and you put your device on it once the app counts down. And the app sends the relevant Wi-Fi and other information via like a flickering barcode situation, like a Morse code kind of thing. So you're not sitting there kind of like logging into the Eggminder as a Wi-Fi device ad hoc, trying to give it data and then logging back out again. You're kind of just giving it this barcode information, and then it you know blinks in a certain way, and you're like, yay, boom. And it's how Quirky does a lot of its things. It's got a couple sensor devices. It's got a couple automated home devices. All of them work this way, which is kind of nice. You use one app to control almost all of it. It's called the Wink app, and it's also pretty good. My only problem with the Eggminder is every once in a while I pull out the app, and it says I have no eggs. when in fact I do. So today I bought a dozen eggs when in fact I had eight already, so whatever. But the idea is pretty good. You know, Quirky, if you guys don't know, is a startup that's focused on getting inventors to submit ideas, having the community uprate those ideas, and when the idea gets uprated enough, it talks to a vendor that got some expertise in the area to put that idea together. So they have brushes, they have like you know brooms that have built-in you know dust bunny removers. They've got you know this thing, the air conditioner that's got Wi-Fi that they built with GE. You know what I mean? So they're you know the stuff is pretty well reviewed once it comes out. The Eggminder, if you're really interested in having kind of like digitally connected knowledge of your eggs, I'd wait for version 2.
I did notice that on the Quirky site that they also have. And I don't know if this is also a joint venture with GE, but they have like just basically generic sensors that you can buy for like $50 a shot, and they will detect light and humidity and heat. And
yeah, it's just the same sensor detects all that stuff: light, humidity, heat, movement, vibration. That is to say, movement when someone moves around it, like motion sensing, and vibration if it itself is moved. And I don't know if that's built with GE, but I do know. That particular device, I can't remember what it is. It also uses the Wink app that I use. And again, when you to set it up, it's really easy. You hit a button, it starts blinking. You turn your app on. You tell that you have a new device, and the app like starts flickering and sends the information via the whatever Super Morse code. And then you're all set and ready to go. I was looking at that device. If that connected to something like a Revolve device, it'd be really tight because it can serve a lot of purposes that Wemo, Insteon, and other guys don't do yet. So. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot on Quirky's site, and you can find great gifts for people like under $15. So a lot of innovation, and I gotta say, when I first heard about Quirky, I was like, "What? What the what?" And now I'm kind of, you know, I'm digging them, except for this Eggminder thing because it doesn't work. And, you know, I read the reviews on Amazon there, and people complained. And I was like, "Well, it's only got a few 1-star reviews. I'm gonna go for it." And then
you took one for the team.
So. I did. I mean, I've got 30 days. I might send it back. I don't know. I'm kind of addicted to the idea of it is a problem.
Okay, so you actually have to sign up to be able to start shopping.
To buy, yeah, but not to browse.
Yeah. So, Tosin, how about yourself? What have you been playing with recently?
Well, this is a little bit of different type of tech than what I normally play, and this is something that I had to use outside. This weekend I spent it both working on R2 parts, but also working on my car. I had a few scratches and a few different coloration marks that I wanted to clean off, because as you know, here in California, maybe not the best drivers out there. So I was talking to a colleague who recommended a solution called Mother's Clay Bar. Clay bar, what that really is it's just kind of like putty. So you literally have putty that you keep moist with either, you know, soapy water or in the mother package, there was this Showtime detailer. And you kind of rub it on the spots in your car. And what it ultimately does is it takes out any sort of discoloration or any sort of roughness and really smooths out the surface. So you continually, you know, this takes some serious elbow grease after a period of time, but it works really well. And you just continually fold over the putty and until you have a nice clean surface and keep at it for a while. But at first I was somewhat skeptical because I was just it's weird, right? Having like a piece of clay sort of like when you're younger and you're just using that against your car, but it actually works surprisingly well.
I would think that would make it more. The natural inclination is to think that it would make it more dirty or more gummy.
No, it actually did a really good job of kind of smoothing and restoring the surface. So often, you know, once your car is no longer new, it sure goes through a lot. And if you slide your finger across your car, you can feel like that sort of roughness. But after going at it with the clay bar, really impressed, very smooth, really cheap solution too. I think for the entire mother package, it must have been like $15 on Amazon. And then
I bet it was cheaper than an egg minder.
Probably. And after going through it with a clay bar, the last thing which I used was this solution called Scratch X. And I had a few scratches on my car that I was trying to, you know, kind of surface. And it's really what it is it's more so a way of removing blemishes and kind of adding, over the clear coat. And this stuff was really amazing. I was first shocked at the clay bar and pleased by it, but, you know, I think I was even more pleased by how the restoration qualities of the Scratch X. And I took some photos of my car afterwards, and I was just like, yeah, that looks a lot better than it did before. So I only did part of my car because, you know, there was only a little – I wanted to test it out first, and then I also wanted to work on R2. But definitely something I would recommend for those who are interested in doing some car restoration in terms of the look.
So what was the name of the first thing? There's Mother's Clay Bar, and there's Scratch X.
Yep.
All right. So if you're going to get on Amazon and you want to spend some money, get those instead of the egg minder right now.
Yes.
Egg minder needs a software patch or something.
Yeah, the clay bar comes – the Mother's Clay Bar package comes with a bottle of Showtime Instant Detailer, two clay bar bars, and it also comes with a terry cloth rug.
All right. I will definitely check that out next time I have a car that's worth detailing. All right, let's get into some of the headlines here. So the FCC's plan for implementing network neutrality came to light last Wednesday in a Wall Street Journal article, which we covered here on the Drill Down. Under that proposed framework, the FCC does away with the concept of non-discrimination and instead offers up a new standard designed to prohibit commercially unreasonable practices, according to the FCC. GigaOM Stacey Higginbotham says that the FCC should man up and say exactly what it's doing here. It's implementing a double-sided market for the internet that could allow businesses to enter into commercial relationships with ISPs who do not operate in a competitive market for the U.S. And because capacity on broadband networks is limited, the flip side is the companies that don't pay will see their content delivered more slowly. Essentially, that there's a duopoly. That there's a duopoly here, and the ISPs are going to be setting the rules. And that is something that is patently unfair. Do it in the ISP's best interest and not in our best interest.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. The idea here that, well, let's just put it out there. When I pay Comcast to get to the internet or to get something from, or to download something from the internet, I'm saying, Comcast, here's my money. Give me access to what I want. Now, Netflix, on the other hand, is on the outside, and they're like on their side of the world, and they push their stuff to the cloud, and it goes right up to Comcast door. The Netflix is paying all the money to get that data right up to Comcast door, whereupon I, as a consumer, say, Comcast, I'm paying you. I want that Netflix that's knocking on your door. And Comcast is like, Yeah, you know what? That's great. Hey, Netflix, Dwayne says he wants you. I'm going to charge you to walk through the door. I mean, he's paying me, but I want you to pay me too. And that's where the problem really is. Problem says that if you're, you know, any kind of distributor of content, the ISP wants you to pay it just to get your content across that last mile of internet.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, Netflix has companies that it works with that it is paying money to in order to get the stuff up Netflix servers and pump it out through the cloud. Just like when you own your own web server and you pay for bandwidth fees, or you own your server and you're, you have your own service and you're paying for other types of connection fees, like how you, you know, just like how with AT&T, you know, you're paying for wireless service. You expect that you can connect to Netflix and just download whatever you want up to whatever your limit is. If AT&T then says, hey man, Netflix, you got to pay me because this person wants to talk to you, that's double dipping. Now, if you're in a position like Netflix, you may not have a choice. You may be like, oh, well, I mean, I can't have – explaining that to a consumer who's not seen the product is going to cost me more than just paying Comcast, at least in the short run. At least that's how it seemed. So Netflix has a statement out there. Comcast has a statement out there. The Comcast statement basically retorts everything the Netflix statement says, kind of like, you know, I'm not. that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I know you are, but what am I, kind of thing. But the bottom line is that these companies that are not competitive, Time Warner, Comcast, they're working very hard to make sure that you're paying for the content that they don't own. So in this era where we've figured out, you know, I don't want to use the Comcast or Time Warner interface on my television set. I don't want to pay them for the content. They are a pipe. I want to use that pipe. They're saying, no, that's too efficient. That doesn't work for me. I'm not getting enough residual income out of that. So if you're going to get content that's I'm not making, I'm not distributing, I'm going to charge a distributor to bring it to you. And I'm going to make up a ballyhoo excuse about it. And that's where I feel like some of the reporting is getting lost in the weeds of technical jargon. Really what it comes down to is they're saying you're paying your cable company to get out to the internet, to pull things down from the internet. And the internet and the cable company is now telling the internet, hey, we're going to pick and choose who we let you contact. And that's the problem.
You know, I think a lot of this – a lot of these moves could lead to, you know, the privatization of the internet, you know, that we know of right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of
what do you mean by that? Lay that out. What is the privatization of the internet?
So where everything now starts to become more secluded, given, you know, you have to pay this person this much money, and it just, you know, they're all. I think as it stands right now, Comcast is the biggest player. But I definitely do think there are a lot of other people, not just Google, but I think there are a lot of other companies, ISPs out there in like Seattle that don't necessarily – that may not necessarily take the same sort of route that the FCC may be suggesting or this particular stance, right? And
like Cablevision in New York, they don't use this kind of deal that Comcast pushed with Netflix in order to get the data through.
Right.
They use very different – they've set it up already and everything seems to work. So
I kind of feel like there for a period of time there might be this sort of dark period, but then or companies may start trying to find ways around it and potentially we might even because of this we might even get more competition. You know what this actually somewhat reminds me of? You know, back in the day when not even that long ago when Microsoft was at the top of their power with Windows with the Windows OS, and when they were, you know, sort of demanding or making pushes to include just their web browser and how that went through its whole legal rigmarole.
They got busted by the DOJ.
Right, exactly. Now
there is that, but you got to understand that these guys have looked at cases like that, and they are working around any loopholes that they found. They have legal – unlike Microsoft, Comcast is a legal monopoly in the areas that it serves, because right now they've been able to convince the government that the only economically feasible way to get people on the internet is for them to have each carved out their own territories and have their own space so they don't have to compete. Because if they have to compete, and there's a price war or a bidding war in the cable space, the cable, not the DSL space or whatever, but in the actual cable space, then it'll get too expensive for them to even offer the service, and we'll have a non-connected United States. That's the argument that Comcast makes to the government, the local governments, to get them in there. And that's an argument that has been working. So unlike Microsoft, that, you know, cornered a market, Comcast got these guys in on allowing them to corner the market, because they claim the only way for anyone to get anything is if it happened, that is if they can control the market.
And I'm not saying that the government is ever going to step in and actually, funny enough, rule for the people, as bad as that sounds. I sort of have my doubts in that area, as we can kind of see from, you know, if you really think about it, how much positive press does Comcast ever seem to get? Not very much. Yet they are still – they still win all the battles they have. You know, there was this article that was sort of talking about – and I believe you sent it – the sort of Comcast brand, or the Comcast country, where, mm-hmm. you know, even in their home state, where there's very low satisfaction, they're not really doing too much for the actual people who live there, they still have all the politicians sort of in their court.
It comes down to the ability to lobby, the ability to do these things. And I think there is a point that you said that I think I agree with, which is to say, if new technologies and new companies like Google and their fiber, or this P-Cell company, or Netflix working with P-Cell to deliver stuff over T-Mobile lines or whatever, if these things can show up, then Comcast will have to open up the spigot and be more competitive. But right now, what we're seeing is what I think is pretty textbook monopoly behavior, to say, I'm the one who controls these pipes, therefore you're going to have to pay me this amount. And let's not forget, what you're paying for your 30 megabits down on cable is not a little bit. It's a lot of money. I mean, like, if you get a deal, you're paying $49, $50.
Yeah.
If you're spending a normal amount of money on it, if you're not doing the triple play, whatever, but you're spending, like, whatever the not deal price is,
that's like $70.
It's $70 to $80.
Yeah.
And that's cheap. Even, you know, in many cases, that's before your local tax is set in. So it's not like they're, you know, they have 60% of the market or something like that, or 40% of the market or something like that, if they were to get Time Warner. These guys are pulling down, you know, $80 a month per household. Let's split the difference and call it $60 a month per household. That's a lot of money. And I'm not saying I know exactly where everything goes or exactly what everything costs, but it seems to me that for that money, you can have Netflix, the Netflix that I want, come in. Or you could spend it in spanning your network so that if everybody wants Netflix, they can get it. Or, you know, subsidies can be given by governments to allow other companies to come in and help share that load on new cable, on new fiber, on new wireless technologies. Either way, something's got to give.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds – I don't know. It sounds greedy to me. Ultimately, I think that's what it comes down to.
It's so frustrating. Right. Anyway – we've said our piece.
right. The bottom line is also here that keep in mind that we don't really know exactly what the FCC has planned, because they haven't laid out their plans in detail. They're coming up, I believe, on the 15th of this month. So we're all judging on what they intend to lay out, but they have not codified yet, and that'll come on the 15th of May.
The frustration we're laying out is the way Comcast seems to define how it should get paid, which is to say, you pay to connect to Comcast no matter if you're the person who's buying internet access or if you're the person who's got something over the internet to do.
They get you coming or going.
Exactly. It's a double dip that is unheard of in normal business practices.
Yeah. And I think once again they can get away with it because of the heavy lobbying that they're doing in Congress. All right, let's move on here. Vic Gundotra, Google's senior vice president for social and one of the creators of Google Plus, is leaving the Googleplex, as reported by Recode. And the common wisdom holds that Google Plus itself will not be long for this world. The Google Gundotra's leaving is the is the first sign that Google Plus is going to be falling. John Battelle suggests that Google likely never cared if Google Plus, quote unquote, won as a competitor to Facebook at all. All that mattered in the end was whether Plus became the connective tissue between all of Google's formerly scattered services, and it's arguable to say that they have. You know, Google Plus is now the default messaging for YouTube, which is a major function. Google Plus has been incorporated, folded into other Google services, so that anytime that you communicate using Google's other services besides Google Gmail, of course, you're using Google Plus. So that's a huge change from 5 years ago, when Google didn't have that option at all. So I mean, first of all, is Google Plus going away? Do we think that it's going away? And if so, does it matter? Is Google Plus as a social service in and of itself even significant in the post in this new era where Google Plus has been folded into all the other social services?
Well, let's talk about this man first.
Vic Adultra.
Yeah, I mean, a big influence. Started out at got a lot of his sort of like personal capital at Microsoft. He was the general manager of platform evangelism. Basically, he pushed Microsoft's APIs to developers and, you know, helped bring about the whole Windows Live strategy, which I think all of us can agree saved Hotmail and everything associated with it, the whole Windows Live thing. He's a heavy hitter on the technology stage. I think in many ways, you go to Google, you look at Google I/O videos, he was the public face of Google. I don't know, in my mind's eye, I can't place Sergey Brin. I can't place Larry. I can place Eric Schmidt and Vic Ganotra, right? And I see Vic walking around with his, you know, V-neck sweater and his like, you know, checkered or gingham like button down, and in many ways, I felt like his excitement and his layout about what Google was doing, what they were planning on doing, and how they were doing it was the antithesis of the Steve Jobs presentation. And I think he really turned Google I/O into something that people wanted to be at. He added a lot of cool factor to Google, whereas Steve Jobs would be like, this is what we're doing, you know, pray unto me. Mm-hmm. You know, Gugendotra was kind of like, hey, look what we've worked on. We think you guys are really going to like it. But more than that, this is how we've made it so that you developers can get the most out of it. This is what we've done so we can get the most out of the web. And it kind of extended to sort of this engineering focus. So anyway, I think it's interesting that he's leaving. He's got a big net worth. It's probably around $30 million, which you would expect. But it's interesting to see him rolling out. Now, when it comes to Google Plus, I remember, I think we all spoke about the why I left Google letter from a couple years ago, where one top engineer said he left Google because of what he called Larry Page's unending drive to make all things Google Plus when they didn't need to be.
Right, right. And I remember there was that, right. Remember there was that memo that I think it was Larry Page sent out that said basically that the bonuses at Google are tied to the success of social. So, you know, social was a front and center focus on getting making a prime consideration for all things, and then it was in
April of 2011. Larry Page, basically, that's when that came out. Larry Page said that every single bonus is tied to the social success of Google.
Yeah.
Now I don't know about you guys, but I do use Google Plus. I don't use it a lot, but then again, I don't use Facebook a lot either. But a social network for me is kind of about where everybody is or how easy the content is to get to. Mm-hmm. And while I think the Hangout feature in the Google Plus app is awesome, for the most part, you know, if I'm going to sit there and like browse my phone on the elevator ride up or down somewhere, it's probably going to be Instagram. It might be Secret, but it isn't Google Plus. And it, you know, maybe Facebook. But I find that Google Plus came after I already had set a paradigm with Google for my own personal use. So I use the search, I use email, and that's, you know, I use Docs. The Plus feature that kind of got layered into everything, and of course I used to use Reader, seemed to almost get in the way of my productivity on Google as a tool. So the turning from Google from a tool into a toy, which is how I view Facebook. Facebook is more of a toy than a tool for me. Is something that, you know, I as a person who's been on Google since like, you know, 04 or whatever, was a difficult shift. One that I don't think I embraced fully, and one that I don't think that I appreciated as much as perhaps the company would have hoped that a loyal user like me would. And if that's going to mean that Google Plus is going to get sunset, I don't know that that's a good thing or a bad thing. I just know that whatever they were trying to do didn't seem like it was touching the users in a way that was meaningful to them or to even want to, like, you know, it never came up in conversation. Oh, this thing happened on Facebook would come up all the time. Oh, this thing happened on Google Plus would not.
Right.
It's one of those
things. At least anecdotally speaking, it seemed like no one was using Google Plus.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I do use it. I mentioned that I use it at the end of every podcast because I do use it. It's just that not enough of my – I would say that because I showed up on it – because it showed up later, a lot of, like, tech people that I know are on Google Plus. Yeah. And so I'll talk to tech people on it. But when it comes to, like, family ties, friends from a long time ago, all these things, those are not the connections that I make on Google Plus. And because of that, again, it's more of a tool, not a toy. Just like the rest of Google's suite of products is more of a tool, not a toy, you know?
Right. Tosin, what about you? What are your experiences with Google Plus? Do you think it's going away?
I don't think it's immediately going away. Like a lot of Google things that they have or purchase, they just kind of hang out in the ethos for a while. You know,
before they get sunsetted.
Right. I mean, they may not put any work towards it, but currently it does the job. I tend to actually use Google Plus.
What job does it do?
Well, actually, for me, it's actually more of a way to start Hangouts for Google Hangouts.
Right. So that's like a huge piece of it for me. Like the Hangout functionality is really magnetic. It just draws me in.
Yeah. That's
kind of hanging out and browsing it, I don't really find that I do that.
No, I definitely don't really find that I do that. But I don't think it's not the sort of thing where Google is going to completely just bail, as in like shut down tomorrow. You know, it's that sort of thing where it's going to be around for some years and maybe they'll let it go out.
Like they did to Reader when they shut it down.
Yeah, I mean, like
overnight.
Yeah, I just don't see that coming.
To the ire of everybody.
I just don't see that coming. I mean, if you think about it, they still have like things like FeedBurner, where they've actually like all the links on FeedBurner have stopped working to things like their support site, and like they made a change to support HTTPS to change over all Google services to, you know, HTTPS, and FeedBurner doesn't work with feeds that are HTTPS. So like, but they haven't officially shut that down yet, right?
But you can see it coming.
Like, yeah, you know that that's eventually going to happen. I think it's going to be that sort of thing where it's just going to eventually happen, but not for a long time. And I think, you know, given there are – I think there are definitely still some draws, as well as there are probably still a decent number of people who were in that, you know, first inception when they added all, you know, technophiles or people from the media who may, you know, use it a little bit more than others. So.
Yeah. So I look at something like Secret that showed up, right? I look at Google Plus, and you know, Secret is kind of like how the web used to be. You know, you don't know who's what. Only in this case, you don't have a fake name or like a handle. It's just kind of super anonymous or whatever. And I find that, to me, that like level of disruption over the what's become the prototypical social network, is more interesting and fun. It's like Instagram without knowing who's posting the picture, sort of. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're just there to like suck it all in. I think in many ways, Google Plus, it tried to do one better on Facebook, and it did a good job of certain things, like the circles, very tight, right? Like the circle thing.
Sure.
That makes your whole privacy situation so much better,
that was
right?
Nice.
It's, It's so much better, the whole Circles thing. And I, you know, if you use an Android device, Google Plus is a bigger part of your lives. Like, we're iPhone, iPad people. We are. I think I've had one Android device in my life, and it didn't last for too long. Unfortunately, it was a G1, and it broke, you know. And then I think, you know, back when I was working at one place, I always had my hand on, like, a Gingerbread device, and I used it from time to time, but it wasn't my main thing. Mobile technology, not unlike social technology, social stuff, is tied to the other people who have it. So, you know, if you have an – I don't know many people who use Android devices compared to the people I know who use iPhones. So I feel like those Android users are going to get way more out of Google Plus than the iPhone users will. Now, I'm not going to lie. On my phone, I have a folder that's all Google. I use Google Now all the time. But again, that's the whole tool versus toy thing. So I'd like to know what if this has to do with Gundogsha's leaving – I'd like to know what he's up to next. I mean, that would be really eye-opening. I mean, he's got a chunk of money. He's 45 years old. You know, it could be that he saw like a ceiling at a company like Google. Hey, I'm never gonna be anything bigger than what I am now. It's time for a new chapter in my life.
Could be true. That's what happened to Melissa Meyer.
Right, right. So, and you know, she went and started heading something else. Then there's always the fact that, you know, he could want to go and start his own thing. But the fact is, from everything I know about him, he's a family man.
Yeah.
He loves technology. He's done really well for himself. And with the kind of bank that he's got in his pocket, there's no reason to think he may just, you know, retire.
Interesting.
Sunset into the whole VC world, you know, that kind of thing.
All right. So from a Google potential failure to a Google continued success. The last we heard from Google's self-driving car project was August 2012, when Google announced that the cars had driven 300,000 autonomous miles. Today, that number has more than doubled to 700,000 miles, and Google's cars are now tackling driving in the big city. The company has taught its cars to detect construction zones by recognizing yellow signs and traffic cones, and the cars can even change lanes as indicated by the cone layout. They now move to keep a safe distance from obstacles like vehicles stopped on the side of the road. They won't stop in the middle of a railroad crossing. And the cars now model things like the likeliness of a car running a red light and can detect cyclists, read their hand signals, predict their movement. And I've also learned not to run down pedestrians and cyclists at crosswalks. That's good. And and can track objects behind them. So Google's self-driving cars have apparently made a huge leaps in navigating city traffic, which is, you know, frankly, that's like a major part of most people's commuting. So it's one step closer.
And this is where they're going to have to do the best, because – so here's like where I get really excited about Google. You guys know how excited I've been about this car for so long. You know, they've got legislation passed because it had done those 300,000+ miles with no accidents. You know, rural streets, whatever. They did that. They can do this city things. And like, if you think about it, I don't know, in my car, I've got like these little sensors in the front that like light up when someone walks in front of the car when I'm close to something or whatever. There's no reason to make the resolution of those better. Make them tighter. And also, when you have things like adaptive cruise control on certain cars today, there's no reason why you can't use that kind of technology to help the vehicle understand what's going on around it. Yeah. So this stuff seems like the kind of progress that is really exciting. Almost a million miles in a vehicle that can do everything on its own. I get so excited about the idea that, you know, traffic collisions go down, users can, and that's what I'm calling drivers now because they won't be driving, users can sit in the car and, you know, take that travel time to do something really productive with their lives instead of getting angry or frustrated or whatever. I mean, you like rocking out some music in your car, there's no reason not to now. And in an age of car sharing, this also becomes a really big thing because Google can take these vehicles in cities, big ones, and begin to displace taxis. Pretty much figure out from an app or whatever, is this place taxis, this place Uber, by figuring out from where you are with your phone or whatever, the best way to drop somebody off and get to you. I really feel like this is the future. I feel like this is one of those things where I don't need a flying car. I just need a self-driving one. That's just – I mean, it's not to say nobody wants to, like, get behind the wheel and put their foot on the gas pedal and just go, go, go. I just feel like this is going to solve a lot of problems. Less traffic, less, you know, less accidents, less everything. Bad.
Yeah, I see the first real-world application of this is going to be taxis and other service vehicles like this.
Yeah, I mean, those are the only guys who are going to be able to afford it. And Google can do things like say, we're going to heavily subsidize the price of this technology in an effort to, you know, do some testing. So Google Fiber is already in Kansas City. What's not to say, hey, Kansas City, we're gonna give you a whole bunch of Toyota Priuses we hooked up already. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, this is perfect for a hybrid vehicle, too, because the start and stop of a city gets you the most mileage out of it. Now, you combine this technology with a plug-in hybrid, and you know, you're probably saving an incredible amount of energy and time for everybody.
Yep. I'm very excited about that. All right. Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And book I want to talk to, first of all, the reason I'm bringing this book up, which is called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace, is because this week is the 50th anniversary of the office cubicle, this year actually, but this month is when it's actually celebrated. So originally designed in 1964 by Robert Probst, the first cubicle was engineered to empower people, improve workflow and connectivity. It was originally called the Action Office, and it had the potential to revolutionize the office space. But not long after that, Probst reworked his creation with the introduction of an enclosed desk system which single-handedly reshaped the corporate environment, the cubicle. It's now in the United States. It's a $3 billion industry. And Cubed reveals the unexplored yet surprising story of the places where most of the world's work gets done. It's a fascinating, often funny, and sometimes disturbing anatomy of the white-collar world and how it came to be the way it is and what it might become. So I thought it was an appropriate choice this week, since we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the office cubicle, which I have worked in a few, and I'm sure you guys have as well.
Yeah.
yeah. Cubicle, office space. Yeah.
I mean, it's become such a part of our culture and pop culture as well. It's, you know, it's where we spend most of our day, I would say, you know,
San Francisco just passed a law allowing, you know, like making so that companies have to get back to you when you want flex time or like want to work from home or whatever. Yeah. So you can't put a request out there and they can just like ignore it. I think the cubicle is one of the reasons where people are like, hey, look, with current technology, I want to work from home. I don't want to be – I'd rather not be around people. I'd rather just be isolated from people than feel like I'm in a 5x5 box all day.
Yeah.
I do all this stuff about free-range chicken, free-range grass-fed beef. What about free-range people?
No, absolutely. I agree. And I think that's part of the discussion of – cubicle life is a discussion of have we been inundated by cubicle life? Is it time for something different? And you know, it was like, if you're gonna, any discussion of cubicle working also has to include the sort of the open office plan from the last 20 years or so, particularly in tech offices where there are no cubicles, but you can take your work, since it's all Wi-Fi, you can take it anywhere you want and work anywhere you want on the beanbag chairs.
Right.
Yeah, which, speaking of beanbag chairs, I was not too long ago at the Tech History Museum, which is here locally in the Bay Area, I believe in Mountain View, and they had on exhibit a beanbag. It was like a beanbag chair, and it's like tech people used to sit on. It was actually really
welcome
hilarious.
To a part of history.
Yeah.
Well, in order to, if you want to get Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace by Nikhil Saval, or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook, plus the 30-day trial to check out their service. Using that URL helps us out on the show, so please do so. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it, and you still get to keep that book for free. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, an entire country gets ported over to Minecraft. Watch out for creepers. So take a listen to this, and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuwakin. In a case that reaches into almost every American's pocket or purse, the U.S. Supreme Court struggled this Tuesday to adapt modern technology to traditional legal rules. At issue is whether police can search cell phones without obtaining a warrant at the time of an arrest. The courts have long allowed police to search people without a warrant when making an arrest, but those searches have been limited by the amount of information individuals can carry on their person. But, of course, with the advent of the smartphone, allowing a search of that phone without a warrant allows police to search far more information than most people keep in their houses. You know, phones are not phones per se. They're pocket computers, and the data that can be contained on our pocket computers can be vast, vast reams of information on criminal activities such as, illegal,
nefarious acts.
Nefarious acts.
Yeah, there's things that can help put people away, and additionally, things that can help keep people away. Yeah. The question is, you know, we've got a Fourth Amendment. That basically lays out that, you know, we're not going to be – there's no general warrants. Warrants for information are based on, you know, probable cause.
Yeah.
Right? That's part of that's part of the whole due process thing. So the idea here that you'd be able to law enforcement would be able to take a look at your entire life simply because – they caught you for anything at all.
Yeah,
is what the plaintiffs here are or the appellants are trying to push forward. For me, this whole thing is interesting because, I mean, on the surface you've got the high level issue. If a cop stops you for anything, should they be able to look at everything in your phone? On the high level, the fact is there's a reason to bring everybody in for questioning. Mm-hmm. They can find the smallest reason to do that. There's nobody in this country who lives their life 100% perfectly. And even if there's nothing there, everything from not wearing your seatbelt is a reason to be arrested. Because, you know, maybe you're on a quick trip and you forgot to click the safety belt in or whatever. So the idea that they can hop in there and look at your phone and figure out, you know, suppose you're gay, you haven't come out of the closet yet, or suppose you have like 50 pounds of coke underneath your bed or something like that. Regardless of that, the idea is that like this kind of data isn't the kind of data that they're looking for when they arrest you, or that has anything to do with the safety of the officer, which is what that that procedure has always meant. The idea that, like, oh, I've stopped you. Oh, I'm arresting you. Oh, now that I've arrested you, let me take a look in your car. That's all about the safety of the officer. And the idea here that they can just kind of like, well, you weren't wearing your safety belt, let me look in everything in your phone. That's a huge, you know, misstep when it comes to the whole idea of Americans, privacy, whatever. Now, some of the people arguing this case said that the minute you carry a smartphone on you, you're giving up your privacy to cops. And to which Elena Kagan, the justice, said something along the lines of, hey, look, does that mean that I have to keep my cell phone at home to have any reasonable expectation of privacy? Because it wouldn't do, you know, and she's alluding to the fact it wouldn't do her much good then.
Yeah.
So these are like big questions. And one of the big questions is, well, you know, if we let the user keep their phone, they could erase their phone and we wouldn't be able to keep them in jail indefinitely. For me, a big piece of this is it's not a good thing that a police person or a prosecutor's career is directly tied to how many people they lock up. Not that they're quotas or whatever, but, you know, the idea that you could arrest somebody and that it doesn't go to conviction is going to not allow you to move forward in your career means that they want to have all the information they can have on anybody all the time so that they can always get a conviction when they arrest you. And that gets in the way of finding out the truth or prioritizing you know, law enforcement capabilities and needs and all these other things like that. So this idea that, hey, I can find out every single thing about you because you're basically walking around with a diary just because your safety belt wasn't buckled is a legitimate problem that I'm very interested to see how the Supreme Court's going to, you know, how they're going to get to that in early June when late June when they figure out how they want to rule on this.
It seems like from some of the discussion of the Supreme Court trial on this, that the Supreme Court justices were, at least half of them, seemed to be fairly tech ignorant on this, on the specifics of the case, in general. And
yeah, that was another thing. There was a big struggle between the technology and the way the law is laid out for these Supreme Court justices. I mean, they're not, you know, you think of technology as a young person's game.
Sure.
These people aren't the youngest people in the world, but they're not completely out of their depth. One way that they looked at it was to say, you know, at the time of arrest, a cell phone holds something like, you know, more than 100 times what the amount of, like, the smallest iPhone 5S holds more than 100 times the amount of data that James Madison wrote down or had collected his entire life. So if James Madison collected 65,000 documents his entire life, the smallest iPhone holds, you know, more than 100 times, 650,000 documents or whatever. And that says basically that when the founders were coming up with the Bill of Rights, they were not anticipating this level of information to be on someone should they get arrested. So the idea that we'd use today's laws based on those founders, the spirit of the founders, to say it's okay to look into someone's complete life because you arrested them is problematic.
Yeah,
I agree, because that's to take it to a far extreme, that's sort of, you know, arresting someone and then saying, oh, by the way, let me go into your house because there's a chance that although I've only, you know, there's a chance that you could tell someone to go into your house and hide things away from me.
Right.
You know, and to a certain extent, it's this sort of train of thought that's, I think, kind of led to where we have been with, you know, the NSA and this, all the monitoring, all the things that people are suddenly finding out about, and I think quite a lot of people may be appalled by it and trying to take a step back. I think it's that sort of like framework where we are always thinking about the guilty and never thinking about, you know, everyone else. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's also that sort of
and
mantra.
Frankly, everybody is guilty of something. Like, if you were to look at the way a totalitarian regime runs things, not to say we are, because we are not. We are very different from a totalitarian regime. You know, there's a reason to bring everybody in. There's a reason to arrest everybody, because everybody's guilty of some little thing. The laws in this country are so pervasive that you can collar anybody if you know everything about them. You can put things together to do that. And that's like that, this whole like...
All right. And that's the slippery slope that we don't want to allow if we let this this law pass through without some sort of discussion or, compromise.
Right. Or the use of the current law. Because the current law, again, says police officer can search your stuff if you get arrested. Anything that's on you, basically. So it's like just saying, hey, is it appropriate that you can search everything that I am? Which is what your phone, which is, I mean, you call it a computer, Andy. I would call it a personal communications device and, you know, storage receptacle. And then there's a difference between what the phone has on it and what the phone's connected to in the cloud, which wasn't even a discussion that they had because they're not even there yet. The whole cloud thing means that I can grab the phone that's on you and I can open up the Dropbox app. Now, that stuff isn't on your phone for the most part. I mean, there's going to be some stuff that's cached, sure. But, you know, that means I can look at every single thing that's on the cloud and that wasn't even on you. So does that count as on you because your phone connects to it because you have an account? You know, these questions weren't even asked. So a big part of this is like the legal system is almost out of its depth when it comes to understanding some of these things. Not to say that these things can't be legislated or these things can't be adjudicated in court. But I was a little astounded that I didn't hear about any expert witnesses coming up to explain these kinds of differences. Because it's not simply that I'm grabbing what's on you. I'm grabbing everything that you are because your pictures are in PhotoStream and I can get access to those.
Yeah.
Because your copies of the deed to your house might be in Dropbox so you can share them with your wife pretty easily. Basically, any and everything that you are can be hanging out there on the cloud and they can grab a phone and say, hey, I've got it. And that's another part of it is, you know, when you grab things from this kind of search and seizure, there's no judge there with a normal like warrant. A judge says, okay, you can only grab this, you can't grab that, and you can only hold it for so long. When things are grabbed by law enforcement during an arrest, they can hold on to it for as long as possible. So the idea that they can grab everything that's in your phone and then, you know, emails, drafts of emails, whatever, and hold on to that indefinitely and possibly store all that stuff in a massive database across everybody else's is, again, problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I think there's more on this discussion that we need to have when as it moves forward through the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll see one way or the other how this falls and the laws that are enacted by result. Okay, so moving on here, in a more lighter note, the Danish Geodata Agency has launched a full one-to-one recreation of the entire country of Denmark in Minecraft. Streets, homes, landmarks, rivers, parks, they're all there, limited only by the cubic meter construction of Minecraft. The product is an extension of Denmark's basic data program, which grants free public and private access alike to the nation's internally developed topographic maps, historical maps, elevation models, and much more. The Minecraft implementation was launched to advertise the project and Denmark's geography efforts in general to the nation's students and educators. The reimagining was so detailed that it had to be split into three maps on three different servers. I think this is amazing. Obviously the United States is a much larger geographical area than Denmark, but I'd love to see the same thing done with the U.S. And it wasn't – the way they did this was – you know, they didn't have armies of diligent Minecraft players recreate Denmark block by block. They took the geodata that was already out there and they essentially ran it through a program that ported it over to Minecraft. And then I think they did some sort of fine-tune honing of the maps.
So what happens when I blow up your house? Is that a crime?
I think According to the articles that I've read, the ability to blow up the geography has been
restricted.
Been disabled.
Yeah, it's pretty. It's actually kind of a unique thing and fairly interesting. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before that. Yeah. I go to a convention called Penny Arcade Expo, PAX, that's sure. in both, all over the country, Boston, Seattle, Texas now, and, mm-hmm. Australia. And so what we've actually done on some Minecraft servers is we've completely rebuilt the buildings, that house, the convention, but, we've also rebuilt a lot of those cities too. So like, PAX in Seattle takes place in so many buildings that we've just rebuilt the entire city or a good chunk of the city, as well as, the various hotels. And it's kind of cool because for people who've never been there, they can virtually experience it.
Yep.
This is no Oculus Rift, but it's still a pretty interesting way of getting sort of a view of a place that you haven't been to.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was such a great service for the Danish citizens as well to, essentially open this up to them. I don't know. I mean, this is so wonderful and educational. I don't know why something like this isn't done here. Other than, I would imagine there might be some balking over.
There's no priority to get this done.
Right.
This is low on the priority list.
Right.
But hey, we could all be in Minecraft together from our various states in our various houses.
You know what?
Do a Minecraft podcast.
This sounds like a terrific project for a Kickstarter.
No, because then your personal location is on Minecraft. It was on like an MMORPG. That's not okay.
Assuming you call out your house, you don't have to.
Yeah,
call
you don't
out
have to. Yeah, you don't have to identify your house as your house.
Okay, so I'm we'll all live in Malibu, in that house they used for Iron Man's mansion.
Oh, I thought you were going to like steal like Bill Gates' house. Or
I like Iron Man's house better.
I'm going to look into the idea of doing this for the U.S. on Kickstarter. Yeah. I'm serious. It's a really good idea. all right, moving on here. Jose Delgado Jr., a 53-year-old who was born without most of his left hand, has used multiple types of prosthetic devices over many years, including a myoelectric version that uses the muscle signals in his forearm to trigger closing or opening the fingers, the cost of which was $42,000, only a portion of which was paid by his insurance and the rest by Jose. That cost makes it an unaffordable option for many people in similar situations. With some help from folks at 3D Universe, he had a 3D printed version called E-Nable made for about $50 out of ABS plastic, which is the same material as Legos. According to Delgado, this simple mechanical design provides him with more day-to-day functionality than his far more expensive myoelectric prosthetic. And if a part does break, a new one can be easily printed in a matter of hours. 3D printing, the reason I bring this up is because, 3D printing is a transformational technology, and his experience with this is a great example of how 3D printing can completely change someone's lifestyle, completely allow accessibility for someone at an affordable level.
Just to like lay it out, so you've got this $42,000 arm,
yeah,
that the guy's using, and then he's hanging out with this 3D printing guru who gives him a $50 version that works better. Let's assume that $50 is kind of like he's not counting his time, materials, sure. research, whatever. Let's just throw that up to $1,000 when you add all that stuff in. The functionality that we see with this hand, and you guys have to check out the video, anyone listening.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of when the iOS 2 came out and suddenly developers could build their own apps. The idea that you know how to do something, you know how to manufacture, you know how to do whatever. The fact here is that once we get 3D printers that are affordable for regular people, mm-hmm. and once we get the kinds of tools that mimic the functionality of or the usability of Photoshop or iMovie or even Final Cut Pro 10 or whatever, then we're going to see materials like this be manufactured on an astounding basis. That's where the transformational piece comes in. And that's kind of why I think this story is a great story to highlight. So looking forward to the near future once the tools get good. But what we don't have now is a place where there's a standard for 3D printing or standards for the actual design software that allow, you know, users to kind of like jump in it in a more democratic space. It's just still too expensive, still too whatever. But the fact that this guy has the talent, has the time, and has the technology just shows you what's capable. So it was pretty exciting to watch this, especially the glee on the 50-year-old dude's face who's getting to use a hand that's better than his previous ones.
I know that there are one or two sort of trailblazing brick-and-mortar sites like this, but I predict a time in the near future when we essentially have a chain of Kinko's-like 3D printing outlets where you can take your design, take it to this place, you know, pay for the ABS plastic, and then get your have them printed out for you.
Yeah, I mean, the Kinko's thing is definitely cool. When you go to, like, co-working spaces now, some of them have – or co-coding spaces, some of them have 3D printers. I think what needs to happen, though, is that – many of the files that these printers use are different depending on the printer and the software and the person who designed the software. There needs to be a certain level of standardization. Right now in mobile, you've got Android, iOS, and Windows Phone. There needs to be some level of, let's call it a PDF or something, that can be translated to multiple versions of these machines. And on top of that, the tools have to be as easy or easier to use than, you know, Xcode, which is what, you know, iOS apps are built on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it's super difficult now. It's just that there's such a bunch of work to get from your concept to the 3D printed version. And the more you can democratize that, the more the person cracks the nut or figures out how to make a piece of software that multiple technically minded people can jump onto and just use without having to worry about which printer it's going to work with or whatever. That system is going to be the one that's going to change the world.
I think we're really close.
We may be.
I think we're within five years away from this.
So which part of this helps the robots take over the world? Is it the cars, the 3D printing, or...
Well, if the robots use ABS plastic, they may be fairly easy to defeat. It's not.
I don't know. I mean, an ABS plastic bullet can still cut through flesh.
This is true. This is true. And if anyone who's stepped on a Lego knows that they can be pretty sharp.
Yeah, God, stepping on a Lego is the worst thing to do. Like, oh my God, you're barefoot and you walk into the kid's room and it's nighttime and there are no lights on and you step onto that standard 2x4 bubbled block.
Uh-huh.
There's no pain in the world. And I you know, and I've talked to women who've given birth. They'd be like, nah, that shit still hurts. That shit still hurts.
Yeah.
You know? It can cut you.
Absolutely.
And if it doesn't, you just limp. You're like, and you bite your lip, right? Because you don't want the kid to wake up. Yeah. That's the worst thing that could happen. So, like, your lip is bleeding now that you bit it, and you're just, like, limping back home. Just limping back to your room. You know, you don't care what Johnny's done. You just want to sleep now.
All right. We're going to take one last break, and when we come back, E.T. phones home again after being buried for 30 years. Take a listen to this, and come on back. You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini, and I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Adafawakin. Microsoft's Xbox division is diving into original television programming for the Xbox One and Xbox 360 gaming consoles, with six committed projects and six more in development. These projects include two different takes on the Halo franchise, one by director Steven Spielberg, and a feature film produced by Ridley Scott. Those are huge names. Other content includes a stop-motion show by the creators of Robot Chicken, a half-hour comedy show produced by Seth Green and Jash, which is the comedy collective founded by Sarah Silverman, Michael Cera, Tim and Eric, and Reggie Watts, and Gun Machine, a hard-boiled detective story based on a Warren Ellis novel, and a sci-fi series called Humans about a servant android with a dark secret. This is huge because it's Microsoft's foray into original television program on the level of Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, notably. This is Microsoft's sort of their admission that this is the next way to go, is producing original content.
It's consistent with what they've wanted. They've always wanted to be in the living room since the original Xbox came out, and building content is clearly the way to go.
Yeah, this is the key, I think, to getting into people's homes in the future is original content, as we've seen borne out by Amazon Prime and obviously Netflix. But
know that Apple's already got Disney in their pocket when it comes to content. So, you know, Microsoft's like, what can I do?
I think this is going to be great. You know, seeing this more than anything else. Seeing Microsoft's announcement of original television program, in particular the Halo stuff with Spielberg and Ridley Scott attached, that to me is more than anything that has been in the past a killer app to get the Xbox One.
I don't know. I mean, Sony, and let's not forget, Sony's already announced, this is a response, because Sony already announced that it was interested in creating a Sony PlayStation TV network.
Yeah.
And to date, already at launch, they could have enough content to have people watching it 24/7 or some crazy number like that. So Microsoft is clearly behind the ball on this, and this is their overcompensation on it. I guess a big piece of this is, you know, they've been collecting the $60 per Xbox user a month for how long now? Given their initial investment in the Xbox, the money that was lost when the Xbox first showed up in order to make it a household name and to make it something that people really wanted. Spending $50 million on a movie is a no-brainer if it gets more people onto Xbox.
Yeah, and Microsoft is definitely trying to position themselves, as you said, as the center of your entertainment needs and center of, you know, center of everything in the living room, right? And this is just another way of getting into that sort of territory and putting more focus on your device. Because I think as it stands right now, although next gen is out, I don't think that sort of next gen gravitas is there, primarily because
it hasn't been adopted yet.
Yeah, and there haven't been that many, like, must-have games. Like, you know, even Titanfall, right, which a lot of people loved, that's available on PC. There's been no real, you know, I would say there's no ground shaker that says, hey, you have to have this.
And the question is this going to be tied to only the Xbox One, or are 360 users going to be able to see this content as well?
That's a very good question.
I think it's both Xbox One and Xbox 360, according to their blog.
That's good, because 360 users might retaliate if they were like, if it was clear there was no software limitation to them seeing content.
Yeah,
and although I would never condone this, one way or the other, this content is going to be able to be found elsewhere on the web once it's released.
You can always just rent an Xbox for a day, or you can buy one and take it back.
True. A little bit more complicated, but I mean this is to me like the killer app for getting an Xbox One, and since that's the one console that I don't own is an Xbox. I have the PS3, I have the Wii. I didn't bother with the Wii U, but
So that's one of the two consoles you do.
Well, because, you know, I'm talking about, if you're talking about major manufacturers, so I got one of Sony.
Nintendo was in a major manufacturer when it comes to consoles.
I got Sony, I got one of Sony, I got one of Nintendo, I don't have one from Microsoft.
I gotcha.
So what I will sort of caution, though, is before you run into this trend, remember, Microsoft still does charge for their online service. So
gold.
Just connecting to the web, just connecting to the internet on your Microsoft device will cost you $20. That's like $60 a year.
Yeah,
the cheapest variation.
Yep.
That is kind of bogus, I must say.
Keep that in mind because I bet you there's a very good likelihood that you know, originals may be in that part of the territory.
Microsoft knows that the future of being set-top box is having original content. And as we've seen from previous reports with Amazon Prime, we discussed Amazon Prime last week, locking up legacy HBO content. And it seems like with both with Microsoft and with Amazon, they are strictly sort of they're fighting for the living room, and they're fighting a two-pronged attack against Netflix, who is the big elephant in the room.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is one of those things where, you know, Amazon and Microsoft are directly competing because they both have set-top boxes, but they're also competing against Netflix because Netflix is, you know, on every box, but at the same time, it's got its own content. And like you said, HBO exclusively dropped its content onto Amazon now, so you can get it no matter how you get Amazon. You can get that old school Sopranos, Oz kind of content on Amazon, and Netflix is missing out, which means that your $8 Netflix prescription seems a lot less rosy when you know that anyone with Amazon Prime can get access to this stuff. In addition, you know, while Netflix is the way that I've seen Doctor Who in the past, the latest hot, sexy BBC drama, Orphan Black, it's like a geek dream. It's like Alias meets Nikita meets, you know, Star Trek, all up in the same show. That's only available. Season 2 is only available on Netflix right now, along with another British drama, Downton Abbey. So if you want to see Downton Abbey Season 4, you have to go straight to Amazon. If you want to see Orphan Black Season 2, you have to go straight to Amazon. And I recommend doing that because you get the first episode for free. So we're seeing Amazon is garnering a lot of hot content, whether it's stuff that they make on their own or stuff that they're acquiring. And while Netflix is kind of dealing with this net neutrality thing, these companies are trying to catch up, either with acquiring other people's content or making their own. And it's going to be interesting to see where Netflix is in a couple of years, given the heated competition from companies that have a far more diverse income stream than their content. So Netflix is primarily a distributor of content. Amazon does almost everything under the sun, as does Microsoft when it comes to technology and content. So this is going to be interesting to see how Netflix pivots in order to make sure that they stay relevant.
Yeah, they're gonna have to fight to do that. But I think they're in a position, in a good position, where they still have a little bit of a lead. They shouldn't rest on their laurels. They shouldn't get too comfortable. But they have a good lead and a good strong user base, faithful user base that they have before anyone else gets really close to them.
Yeah, there's that.
All right, moving on here. When Steven Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial premiered in theaters in 1982, it was an unqualified smash hit, making millions for Universal Studios and anyone lucky enough to have a merchandising deal with the film. It reportedly cost game maker Atari millions of dollars to get the rights to produce a video game tie-in, but the development was rushed to market and the resulting E.T. game was a massive flop and considered one of the worst titles of all time.
It was a catastrophe.
It was a catastrophe.
It was like Gmail Brown.
Did you ever play it? Have you?
I did.
I actually played it too. It was, I mean, first of all,
it had nothing to do with E.T.
Atari 2600 games, as they were, being 8-bit games, are already sort of not they're not conducive to the best graphics or sound, but there have been creative developers who have been able to squeeze the most out of the 8-bits. The developers of the ET game were not amongst those who were creative enough. I mean, this was a cash grab, essentially. And because of that, it was ugly. It was hard to control. It was buggy. And so like 2/3 of the people who bought the game took it back. And so Atari was on the hook with over 3 million surplus copies of E.T., the extraterrestrial game.
So people brought it back, but the word got out, and this is before Amazon user reviews, that the game sucked. Yeah. So people, like, in the immediate release of the game, a bunch of people bought it, and they complained about it a week or 2 weeks later and brought it back. So they had those cartridges, but then no more cartridges would get sold. So yeah, they ended up with, you know, I don't know what number you're going to use, but they ended up with these millions of things,
many million.
Of which had never been opened.
Yep. And so, I mean, they couldn't give them away, and they couldn't sell them at a deep, deep discount because they'd be losing all this money. And there was at the time, there was what they called the video game crash of 1983, which is there was a plummeting interest in video games in North America. This, you have to keep in mind, this was before Nintendo. Nintendo was the new renaissance of video games.
Nintendo was the iPod of video games.
Yeah. And that had not been introduced to America yet. So we were in a America was in a crash of interest of video games. And so Atari decided to dump its surplus into a landfill. According to reports at the time, the story was never confirmed, however, and it's carried on as a legendary tale from a time when video games were near worthless. Well, this week, that story is no longer a myth. Construction crews have uncovered copies of the Atari 2600 game at a landfill deep in the New Mexico desert near the city of Alamogordo as part of an upcoming documentary produced by Microsoft for the Xbox Original Content Initiative that we spoke about previous to this. So that's another one of the original programming that's going to be on the Xbox One and the Xbox 360, is this documentary about the uncovering of the E.T., the extraterrestrial games.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's obviously a bit of history and everything. I feel like this legend, it's a little sad that the sort of, like, spooky boogeyman of video game production, don't mess it up or else you'll end up in the landfill. That's all, like, you know, it's... I mean, it's a real thing, so
yeah.
It's like a cheeky joke now, but before it was just kind of like, oh, did that happen? I don't know. Like, the mystery surrounding it is a little gone, so
yeah,
that's a little sad.
I don't know if there was really even that much mystique, because to tell you the truth, like, everyone knew it was supposedly there, and then it didn't really take very much digging to get it.
No.
It was like, oh,
but
yeah.
Thing, it's still a mystery because you didn't find it, because no one's going to go out and spend the money to go check it out,
right,
except for Microsoft, who's getting Steven Spielberg to develop content. Yeah. And you know, Steven Spielberg's like, the last time my stuff touched a video game, it all got screwed up.
Right.
that's how Steven Spielberg talks. You know?
I think he was ahead of his time back then, and now I think he's in his time. Like, he's realized the convergence of Hollywood and Silicon Valley, and I think this is the right
he's
time.
Like, I can't let James Cameron get all the juju.
Yeah.
Because that's how he talks.
Exactly.
When you talk to Steven Spielberg, that's how he talks.
He mentions juju a lot. Exactly. I think now the interesting thing about
had a lot of juju.
As part of our drill down video of the week, the video that I chose was a video called "When I Wake Up" by the band Wintergreen. And why you asked, have I chosen this particular video for our video of the week? Because although there is an upcoming documentary produced by Microsoft documenting the uncovering of this legendary cache of video games in the New Mexico desert, Wintergreen's 2006 video "When I Wake Up" dramatized that legendary search for the E.T. video games, they did it in a very creative and fun way, which essentially tells you the entire story of the E.T. game and its failure and its burial and its legend. And then the guys in the band go searching for it, and there's a happy ending for them too in the video, although it's a dramatization on their part. So check out that video. We're gonna have it embedded in the show notes. Good song too. All right, I think that is going to do it for our show, with the exception of going around the table here. And I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work on the internet this week?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can always check me out on Google Plus, just kind of chatting away. That's gplus.to/DwayneD. And I'll be here on the Drill Down, drilling it down.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the show?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. Other ramblings are back on schedule and on top at the ircwebcast.blogspot.com. And finally, my R2D2 blog at toastr2d2.tumblr.com. I know I've been teasing some updates, but took a lot of photos. We did some actual painting. Gonna post those. And my R2 dome shipped today, so I will be getting something really cool in the next couple weeks.
And documenting it,
I hope. Excellent.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or do a Google search for Mr. Baby Man, my social network handle, and you'll find all my stuff there. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. You can let us help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Oh,
thanks.
And don't forget, May the 4th be with you.
Never forget.
Yes. Before we sign off here, I have to ask you guys about your thoughts on the casting news. So, Star Wars announced their cast list for Episode 7. And amongst them were some relative unknowns. So, the relatively new actors to the franchise include John Boyega and Daisy Ridley, and it's rumored that these two are going to be our leads. John Boyega was in Attack the Block. Daisy Ridley has done practically nothing. Adam, I mean, not to disparage her.
No, I mean,
her
Star
body
Wars
work.
Was always about bringing new talent.
Sure.
I don't know what Mark Hamill did or Carrie Fisher did before Star
exactly.
Wars. But I got to say, and I've said it before, it's exciting to see people who aren't, you know, just someone who happens to look a little bit like the comic book character making it onto screen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm all for that.
I am a little disappointed, though.
Why is that?
There's an omission of some guy who I think blew up the Death Star and saved the world. He was a pretty dashing and suave
individual. And someone who you've been championing.
Yes. I never forget. Billy D. Williams.
Right. Lando Calrissian. Yeah,
so does
true.
that means that Lando Calrissian is not going to be in this next Star Wars episode?
That's we just don't know. Like, it's not in the list.
I mean, there could be a guest appearance, but so far it sounds like we might have another petition on our hands.
But okay, now I wouldn't.
Well, a cameo would be nice.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
But I wouldn't
like
worry
Bill
too
Murray
much about it
Zombieland.
Because don't they? Doesn't Disney plan to have a new Star Wars movie out every year?
He's not getting any younger, Andy.
But I mean, you don't want to shoot your entire wad in the first movie back, right?
So then go by age and health. It's like every time I see George R. R. Martin in some interview, I'm like, come on, man, finish the damn books. I mean, Billy Dee Williams, I saw him on some he was on Undercover Brother, wasn't he? Like
in a cameo? Dancing with the Stars.
So, you know, maybe he's pretty healthy. Maybe he's healthier than Harrison Ford, who, you know, probably smoked a lot of weed and did a lot of coke back in the day. But, yeah, it'd be, you know, granted, I'd like a little surprise. I feel like today's movie news is all about, like, oh, this is what we found, and it was in Variety, and it was on Slash Film, and yada, yada, yada. It'd be nice to be a little surprised when we walk into that theater and we see this movie that J.J. Abrams might ruin, just to see it, you know, see something that we couldn't expect or shouldn't be anticipating.
We know that some of the regulars will be back. We know Peter Mayhew will be back as Chewbacca. Anthony Daniels and Kenny Baker are coming back as C-3PO and R2-D2. Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher are coming back. And Harrison Ford is rumored that he may have quite a large role in this upcoming movie.
As long as it's not like the role he had in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, because that was not, he was not worthy of legacy.
Some of the the more interesting announcements I thought were interesting is that the Adam Driver is amongst the cast, and I don't know if you guys know who that is. He's a regular on Girls, which is one of the best written shows on television.
We won't argue about Girls.
But Adam Driver is a guy whose character on Girls I initially hated, and then when I saw the actor in other things, I realized how good of an actor he was. Oscar Isaac, who was the star of Inside Llewyn Davis, and he's got a major role in this upcoming Star Wars. Who else? Oh, Andy Serkis. So that's always a good sign. Andy Serkis, I feel like, is a good totem. It's like your good luck charm for any major franchise fantasy film. And Domhnall Gleeson, who's also a regular British actor who's been doing some really good stuff in the last few years, including he's one of the
Weasley brothers.
Weasley brothers, yes. Max von Sydow. That's a big announcement. Max von
Sydow. He's always scary.
Yes. Yes. He is 85 years old, still working in movies, and he's going to be, I'm hoping that he's going to be a member of the Sith, because I think that would fit in perfectly with that sort of imposing.
I hope he's something that we can't even anticipate what he's going to be, because it's going to be so exciting and new and different.
Yeah.
That's what I hope.
All right. I'm down with that. So, I mean, what do you guys think? John Williams is going to be doing the music again.
How old's he?
Which is surprising, actually. For a second, I really thought that they might use what's the name of the guy who always does it?
Michael Giacchino.
Yeah, for a second, I thought they might do that. Which would
wait? He always does what? Michael Giacchino.
Michael Giacchino does J.J. Abrams movies regularly. He's his go-to guy.
Oh, that would explain why they sound so awful.
Oh, come on!
Wow! I like his stuff. So,
well, I think
If you're gonna complain about the lack of Han Solo, Lando Calrissian, then everybody would complain about the lack of John Williams. Star Wars is inexorable from the score that John Williams created. That is heavily, you know, reminiscent of Beethoven's Fifth, and is just like a huge, huge piece of what makes the fandom what it is.
I think
whenever I hear 20th Century Fox or 30th Century Fox drums, immediately my mind goes to Star Wars. It goes to John Williams.
I think at the very least, having John Williams do this episode 7 is a great sort of connective tissue. You know,
his score, his initial score will always be at the beginning of a Star Wars movie.
Sure. And, you know, likely, I mean, that's, and rightly so. Rightly so. Mm-hmm. I think no matter who does the score for the rest of the movie, I think at the very least, we should have that, continuity of having.
It's the
John
tradition
Williams
that
score.
Most geekdom is made. It's like the fanfare of geekdom.
It's like the 007 theme, the James Bond theme at the beginning of every James Bond movie.
Yeah, I would say it's bigger. It's as bigger than that. Yeah. It's huge. It's huge. So yeah, I mean, I think that the music, John, if you're gonna do it, you gotta have John Williams at least at least, you know, even if he's got his apprentices or something doing it, you know, his name's got to be on it. But, I mean, let's face it, it's been 10 years since the last Star Wars movie came out. And by last, I mean, you know, it was like the last, let's call it, real, same characters, all that stuff. So, this is going to be something that I think that we can be really excited. Like, there's a lot of pressure on them.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of chance that people can be disappointed. So I would go in there with the lowest possible expectations just so you come out feeling okay. I mean, that's why The Matrix was a success. No one thought, you know, Keanu Reeves was going to kick ass like that.
Right. Not based on Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Exactly.